Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Each week, Brenda brings you interesting guests and timely topics to uplift and motivate you to be all that you can be today and for all your tomorrows. Join Brenda and Alive to Thrive every Friday at noon Central Time, right here on Greater Good Ministries Radio. And now, here's Brenda Fraser.
Hello, and welcome to Alive to Thrive. That was a short clip from Eye of the Tiger by Survivor, and that song has lots of meaning to our guest today, who is a survivor herself and is just a living example of the whole premise of this program, Alive to Thrive. She is thriving now, but she has gone through some incredible things in her life. She's a young, beautiful woman. Name Serafina Bianco, if you've read her book, The House on Sunset. But she's revealing her identity today. She wrote under a pseudonym because she survived domestic violence at the hands of a man she was involved with, and he almost killed her. And as many survivors of domestic violence have had to make the hard choice of living with another name, some have moved out of state, some live undercover all their lives, for fear that the abuser will come back into their life. So I had the honor of meeting and hearing her speak last fall at the Safe Connections event in St. Louis, their annual event, Voices Ending Violence. And we connected, and I just so admire her strength and just her good nature. She's just a wonderful woman out to change the world. So Serafina, welcome to the program. I'm using your pen name now, but how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. I've been very passionate about domestic violence and helping women. I've worked at a domestic violence shelter in Washington, D.C. back in 1997, so I'm intimately involved with the issue, and also you know, something you probably don't know about me is that my mom left in the middle of the night with four kids, threw them in the car. We drove from Virginia to New Hampshire, and someone tried to run us off the road. And then soon after we got to New Hampshire and to my aunt's house, a couple of days later, the car was stolen, and she really thought my dad had something to do with it. And we never could prove that one way or the other, but my guess is he probably did, but nonetheless, I understand the issue, and welcome again to the program, and just so powerful, your story, it's a memoir, and for those that are listening that haven't seen the book, it's called House on Sunset, and it takes place in Missouri, and it really grabs your attention right from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about the story, and tell us your real name and why you chose to come public now with your name.
Okay. So we'll start, I'll start with why I decided to go public. So my real name is Lindsay Fisher, and, you know, I've been writing using my pen name for the last 4 years of my recovery. And so I guess originally when I started writing, it was a way to sort of vent. I didn't know that there were nonprofits that helped survivors. I didn't know that there were resources available to me, and I didn't understand what or how post-traumatic stress disorder was affecting me. And so my way of sort of releasing some of that anxiety was to write. So I started writing a blog, and I didn't expect anybody to read it, but all of a sudden I started having these followers, and people were reaching out to me and saying, thank you for writing and sharing their stories with me. And so not only was it empowering to me to be able to be honest about my experience, but I felt empowered by other people coming forward and saying that I was helping them. And so this process has been amazing, but it's also been very interesting, because what ended up happening is I decided to turn my story into a book. And so in doing that, I released it in October, since it's National, you know, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, under my pen name. And what happened is my audience kind of exploded again. And so more and more people started reaching out to me and thanking me. And what I started to feel after, you know, 3 years of trauma therapy and a lot of time healing, was that I wasn't being as authentic as I possibly could be. So for a long time, Serafina Bianco protected me from my abuser. And I'm at a place in my life right now where I feel like I don't need that anymore. I don't need that protection, and I'm ready to stand on my own. And so to be as authentic and real as my book is with my audience, I've decided to sort of step forward and unveil myself. So that's kind of where all of that came from, yeah.
Wow. And how did you pick the name Serafina Bianco? What did that mean
Bianco,
to you? What was
Bianco is half of my maiden name, so I just kind of cut it in half and used it. And Serafina is kind of a funny story, because I'll give you the short version, but, you know, I come from a very Italian family, and my first name is Lindsay, and my sister's first name is Sarah, but my grandpa used to always call her Serafina, because he was very Italian, and so he would speak Italian to us, you know, randomly, and use Italian words, and he would always call her by her Italian name when we were little. And I would always ask, you know, well, what's my Italian name, Gramps? And he would be like, you don't have one. So I always remember that. So I stole it for myself, and I said, all right, well, I'm going to have an Italian name now. So that's where it came from.
That's funny. And how did she feel about you honoring her in a way with the pen name?
You know, we haven't really had a conversation about that in a long time. So I know she's very proud of me, and I know she's very supportive of it, and she has never said anything negative. But, Sarah, if you're listening,
that's neat.
And you
that's
have
a great story.
I'm sorry.
So tell us about, you know, and the Italian culture, you know, without making too many stereotypes, you know, it's an expressive culture, and traditionally the men were the head of the household, and it's a very a lot of the Italian families I know are very expressive. I mean, I personally identify with those kinds of families where there's, you know, a lot of passion is expressed. And I mean, did you ever witness violence in other families, or witness it growing up in the neighborhoods, or had you ever witnessed domestic violence in anyone else?
No, and as a matter of fact, I grew up in a fairly stable, my parents were divorced, but it was an amicable split, and so I spent a lot of time in both households, and I never saw really any confrontation from either of them, and so, you know, domestic violence was something that I assumed happened elsewhere. You know, it wasn't going to happen in my life. I was the stereotypical, you know, suburban girl who grew up as a dancer. I was on the dance team in high school, and so I was just this little cheery blonde girl with dimples that thought life was wonderful. And I'm very fortunate to not have that in my background, but I think part of the reason that I ended up where I did is because I didn't have much education, and I didn't know the warning signs.
And that is so important to get that message out to young women and to women of all ages, that things that start as put downs, verbal put-downs and shouting and pushing and shoving often escalate to something more serious. So what were the warning signs that you ignored to see that were happening prior to the violence getting to the point that it got to?
I think for me, because our relationship happened pretty fast, and most people will tell you, you know, I was in my abusive relationship for 18 months, and a lot of people will tell you that that's an extremely short amount of time typically for an abusive relationship. Most women stay longer, or men, or whoever, the abuser, you know, will sort of manipulate for longer to get you more vested. So what happened with me is that my abuser used a lot of alienation tactics that I didn't necessarily see as alienation in the beginning. So what would happen is he would say things like, you know, he had his own office. He was very successful in his profession. And he would often say to me, you know, I have a dinner meeting with this client tomorrow, and I know that you were supposed to go out with your friends tonight, but, you know, I would really like to spend tonight with you instead. So if you could cancel that or reschedule it, that would be great. And so a lot of times, or something like, hey, I typically went to my family's on Sundays. Like you said, it's a big Italian saying tradition, you know, and so we would always have Sunday dinners together, and I would get ready to go over there and invite him, or, you know, just say I was going, and he would always come up with a reason why I shouldn't go. Now, in the beginning, it often sounded like he just wanted to spend more time with me, so it was flattering. It was something that I thought, this guy is really into me, and what he was doing was pulling me away from the people that kept me the strongest.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely a pattern, I think, with abusive people, that those things happen, and eventually the friends and the support system is eroded to the point that the woman is without a support system and without her friends, and the family does not know what's going on sometimes, and the friends do not know what they think something's up, but they don't know. And I think that I want to talk later in the program with Ellen Reed of Turning Point about that issue, about what people can do if they know someone who is currently in an abusive situation. So we'll get to that later in the program. But so let's talk about your story. So was it a whirlwind romance that you got involved very quickly with this man? Did he sweep you off your feet, proverbial?
Yes. The short version is I had just graduated from college. I was teaching high school. I have a degree in high school education, English. And so I was teaching high school. I had all of my ducks in a row. I thought, you know, life was coming together at the age of 24. I was very happy. I had a boyfriend at that point, and he actually ended up telling me on my 25th birthday that he was cheating on me and broke up with me at dinner on my birthday. Yeah, so that was awkward. But what happened is that because of that, I sort of started to struggle. Like, wait a minute, the rest of my life is in place. And at 25, you don't really know. You know, you don't have a lot of life experience yet, even though you think you do. And so I started, and at that point, MySpace was the big social media outlet. And so to distract myself from what I was struggling with and maybe what I was a little bit insecure with, I started talking to people online. Now, it wasn't specifically to meet a mate or anything like that, but it was just to kind of distract myself. I was talking to women and men. And so he was one of those people that I connected with. We continued talking and really sort of solidified a relationship online, but what happened is he asked me if he could call me. He wanted to hear my voice. He wanted to talk on the phone. And so I said no a couple of times, and when I eventually said yes, we got on the phone, and of course it was one of those conversations that last all hours of the night, you know, in a new relationship. But what really happened, and I think what really pulled me in, happened while we were on the phone that night, and it, because while we were talking, I went outside of my house, and I was standing out there in the night, and just to kind of get, you know, a change of pace, really, a change of scenery from that long conversation. And so I was standing outside, and there were train tracks about a block and a half away from my house, and a train came through at the same time every single night, and I always knew what time it was based on when the train came through. And I started to hear it coming through, but since it was a block and a half away, it was still pretty loud, especially when I was standing outside. And so I went to give him a warning while we were on the phone and say, hey, I'm not going to be able to hear you, so we may have to just, you know, pause for a minute because this train is coming through. And his response to me sort of stopped my breath and my heart, and he said, that's weird, I can hear it too. And as soon as he said that, the train whistle went off, and I could hear it through the phone line and also through, you know, my ear that was not attached to the phone. So I'm spinning in circles looking for this man because I know that he is right by me. I hear the same train coming through. And what ended up happening is I found out that his office was just on the other side of the train tracks. It was actually, if I was standing in my front yard, I could see it. So I could see into his office from my front yard, and that's sort of how we met. So.
That's bizarre. So you started dating, and then did you move in together?
We did move in together. Originally, I had just bought a house about a year before I met him, and he was renting an apartment. He wasn't from the area. So he was renting an apartment, and when his lease was coming up, he was looking at, you know, renting closer to his office. But because I was in this house by myself on a teacher's salary from a rural school district at that, so it's not a lot of money, you know, he suggested, hey, if I moved in with you, then I could pay you rent, and you could use that for part of your mortgage, so then your bills are going to be lower. So he ended up moving in with me after that, and I thought that that was going to be something that was financially beneficial, when in fact it ended up sort of ruining my finances, but, you know, that's later in the story. So
do you want to talk about the pattern that increased, or do you want to, I think it might be better to start at where it ended up. And the first chapter of the book, which is very, very descriptive, I felt my heart pounding and when I read it, and even knowing what to expect, what the book was going to be about, it's still extremely, it places the reader right there in the situation with you when you're on the floor getting kicked, getting verbally put down and fearing for your life and wanting to mentally check out from that situation. So many women, even with very serious abuse, physical and mental abuse, find it difficult to leave, or they will call a hotline, or they will reach out, and then they go back. But you were able to leave. Tell us a little bit about that. What was the point that you realized, A, you needed to leave, and B, that, you know, you could leave, that there was an escape route?
Right. Okay, so I wanted to leave much earlier than what I did, and a lot of people in abusive relationships end up going back multiple times, and a lot of that is because, you know, when you're inside of that, and I know just speaking from my experience, what you're hoping to do for that other person is help them. You think that they are sick, you think that they are savable, and you want to be the person that can help them, especially with my background in education and teaching. That is something that's very important to me. I like being able to help other people. It's fulfilling for me. And so when I'm looking at this person who I'm in love with and I see a problem in them, you know, my goal wasn't to just walk away from that and say, I can't do this anymore. And a lot of people don't understand that, but when you're inside of it and you've fallen in love with this person, you know, they give you this romantic image of who they are initially through the cycle of abuse. So there's the honeymoon phase. And so you meet this person that isn't necessarily them, but they're really good at convincing you that they are. So I'm trying to save that person from the trouble that they're going through. And so, you know, there were a couple of times that I went back, but specifically on the day that I left, the violence had gotten drastically worse just in that last week that I was with him. 3 days before the day I left, he held a gun to my head and told me that he loved me so much he could kill me. And so at that moment, I thought that if I walked out the door, that gun was coming back down after he put it, you know, back on top of the refrigerator. I was convinced that walking out of the door meant that I was going to be shot. And so I thought that staying with him was safer because even though I was miserable, at least I still had my life. I was still breathing. I was still living on some level. And so I stayed. But on the day that I left, he threw me down a flight of stairs and met me at the bottom, kicking me and then eventually choking me. And in that moment when he was choking me, I knew that staying in that house probably wasn't any safer than if I tried to leave. And so I decided to defend myself. It was one of these moments where, you know, the fight kicked in instead of the flight. I wasn't trying to be submissive. It was one of those moments where I knew that if I did not stand up to him, that this could get much, much worse. And I genuinely believed that he was going to choke the life out of me. And so I stood up to him because if I was going to die, at least I tried. And I think because that was the first time I did that, it really shocked him and put him sort of, I don't want to say in his place because he certainly doesn't have a place, but, you know, it shocked him enough to where he kind of backed up and realized, okay, am I really going to do this? You know, can I really kill someone? And told me that I had an hour to get my stuff together before he was coming home. And so, I grabbed as much as I could from the house. And I drove myself back to my house.
Wow. And at what point, I know later in the book it talks about the, you know, interacting with law enforcement. Did you press charges?
I did try to press charges at one point. And that was actually part of the reason that I think it was very easy for me to go back to him is because there were two times that I had police interaction in my relationship, and both times was a very negative experience for me, and so I did not feel supported by the police department. Now, I think part of that is being in a state of trauma and not understanding what they were asking of me, but I also think part of that was because of his connection with the area that we were living in at the time. He had a lot of connections, and so when I tried to press charges against him, you know, the mayor's office was in the same building, and he was his client, and we used to go to dinner with him all the time, and so everybody knew who my abuser was in the community, and he was a successful person. I think what was so challenging about that is the day I wrote the police report, and I sent it back to, obviously, the department with, or the station with the police officer, and he told me to call the next day just to check in, and then we could kind of talk about the process, that he wanted to give me a little bit of time to think about what I was doing and, you know, think about what everything was happening, so to call him. So the next morning I called him, and he didn't pick up, so I left a message, and then I called back the next day because I hadn't heard back, and I talked to the lady who picked up the phone, and told her, kind of explained to her what was happening. And so she looked on their system for my name and didn't find anything. So the police report that I had written had completely vanished, and I never heard from the other police officer again. So while I can't necessarily, again, it's sort of like your situation, while you can't necessarily, you can't 100% say that, you know, somebody, your dad stole that car, you know, I'm 99% positive that something happened where one of his connections was able to get those police documents erased completely. And so when that happened, I knew that I didn't have that support, so I never reached out to them again after.
Wow. I'm going to bring Ellen Reed onto the program. Ellen, for listeners that are joining us, Ellen is the director of an organization called Turning Point. And they are a program that believes in the right of all people to live free from violence. And she works on a daily basis with domestic violence survivors that are coming into shelter and calling a hotline. Welcome, Ellen, to our program. I want to make sure we got a good connection here. Welcome,
yes.
Ellen. How
Hi,
are you
how
doing?
Are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. So
Thanks
I know
for
you've met
me.
Lindsay.
Yeah.
I know you've met Lindsay.
Hi, Ellen. Hi.
recently. But Ellen, tell us about, well, you know, you've seen all stages of this whole cycle, but tell us about the cycle of domestic violence and how it starts and how and why women stay and what we can do to support the women who are trying to leave.
Sure. Well, you know, the for some women, there is sort of a cyclical nature to it, but a lot of women experience domestic violence as an ever-increasing problem in their life. So I listened with interest as Lindsay talked about the red flags. You know, they're much easier to identify in hindsight. One of the things that we really try to do is help women who are coming through shelter understand the next time what those red flags are so they can avoid being in that situation earlier. But for many women, it can start out, you know, we don't date someone and it immediately goes bad and then date them a second time. This is something, you know, there's something compelling that gets people connected to each other and unwilling to, you know, or wanting to be together. And then we start seeing a lot of belittling and name-calling and controlling behavior, very much like Lindsay was talking about her, you know, having a long-standing family tradition of Sunday afternoons with family and her partner pulling her away from that, finding a way to isolate her from her family. We don't necessarily, when in abusive situations, we don't necessarily see physical violence early or often. For some people, it certainly is. For others, we hear about extremely controlling behavior that starts to dehumanize the victim, that they feel like they have no ability to control their lives. They have no decision-making power. They begin to lose their possessions. They lose their bank accounts. They lose their independence, and they lose their motivation. And then when the victim is at her greatest or his greatest resistance to that kind of control, we often see physical violence start for the first time. Others certainly see it much earlier and see physical violence pretty quickly, shoving, punching, slapping, you know, that sort of thing. But at the point that the victim is at her greatest resistance is when we see the greatest physical violence involved and sexual violence as well. We do see guns pointed at heads. We see a lot of Russian roulette. Unfortunately, we also see many gunshot wounds. So it's not just playing around. It's not just a threat. It is a very specific type of violence intended to increase control and terror.
And so I know there's just limited resources in the community and limited numbers of beds. I think in St. Charles County there's only, 5 or 10 beds in the whole county for women leaving a situation?
I think there are a few more beds than that, but there is only one shelter that's physically situated. The nice thing, less than half of all...
And that's true across the country. I mean, I'm speaking about
true.
Missouri, but across the country, there's very little resources for women, and I think the stereotype about going to a shelter is that women think it's like maybe bunk beds or, I don't know, worse than Salvation Army, and it's not. Most of the shelters I've seen are really homey and decorated nice and clean and loving and just they're really beautiful places and they make
well,
them
you
very
haven't been to ours.
I haven't been to yours. But they're not the stereotypic what I think some women
they're not institutional looking.
Yeah, and one of the things Lindsay and I were talking about earlier before we were on the air is that how hard it is for middle-class women to think about going to a shelter, you know, because they might have a credit card or they might have an option to, you know, go to a hotel. And so I think they're almost in an invisible population because they're not even measured by, you know, any of the hotline call numbers or,
right.
you know, so I think the statistics we hear about domestic violence in the United States are much, much higher because a lot of things don't go report, you know, are not reported to law enforcement, are, you know, and if they are reported, it's very rare for the case to go all the way to trial because the woman fears her life or because she doesn't want to face her abuser in court, and many reasons, or she doesn't have child care, you know, or whatever. So what are some resources, not only in this state, but in other states, that if a woman is going through, you know, what's the first step? Is it calling a hotline? Is it telling one confidential person, maybe through a church or something, reaching out to someone? What do you think, Ellen?
Yeah, well, you just hit on a whole lot of different things. So
yeah.
I want to sort of underscore some of what you said, that there are resources. There are not necessarily shelters in every county. In Missouri, we have less than half of the 114 counties actually have a shelter in them. Many of the shelters out in, not in the urban areas, serve many, many counties. Like we have four core counties that we serve, but we also accept women all the way basically from the Mississippi to Columbia along the I-70 corridor. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it is shelters. Most of the domestic violence shelters are comfortable, crowded, communal, not institutional looking. They are, most of them are not newer construction, which can have both its upside and its downside. A lot of them do have bunk beds, and where adults have to sleep in bunk beds, and range anywhere from private rooms to multiple people type dormer type rooms. So when you talk about what we call women with means or people who have some money, they do not get caught up in the data that's being captured by those of us who actually work in the field unless they are calling our hotline. And that's where we tend to see them showing up. It may not be coming into shelter. One of the things we have to remember is a very, very small percentage of victims actually come into shelter. They come in for two reasons. The first one is safety of, he's going to kill me if I don't get behind walls and I have nowhere else to go because he's promised he's going to kill my family, my best friend, and we see that happen. So safety is absolutely the first reason they come in, but the second reason they come in is the intensity of the poverty and homelessness that happens in the wake of both domestic violence and sexual assault, that she has nowhere to go. She has lost her income. He has stalked her. She's lost every job she's had. She may be undereducated and can't get out of the crisis mode that she's in, and comes in and then has a hard time getting out of shelter. Now, separately, and I think it's very, very important for people to know, and one of the things that we have to do better is actually promote this side of our services, is we have non-residential services. And we have, this is where we catch women of some means or men of some means, depending on what's going on, coming to us for court advocacy, help with housing, help with medical care, all types of advocacy-related things. They never step foot in shelter. They just need somebody to help get them through the system. Just like Lindsay captured so extremely well, we see women of means who are partnered with somebody who has power connections, and that often becomes her top challenge, and having an advocate help work around that can be useful. It can be very, very difficult. The other thing that she mentioned is a police report disappearing or not being handled well, and that is one of the areas that we do most of our non-residential work is around making sure that victims have good equal, appropriate access to the criminal legal system and the civil legal system. Because it's
And navigating all that. And I know there are groups out there that do provide pro bono attorneys. So I think I meet women every now and then that, you know, don't think they have access to legal help. But there are those resources out there, legal advocates for women and legal aid and various programs that do offer legal help. Lindsay, let's get back to your story. So from the time of leaving to the time of speaking on at a major event like you were last fall, who connected you to Safe Connections, and how did you first learn about them as an organization that serves women like yourself?
So to kind of go backwards just for a second, I think it's important to note that, like, one of the things that I think is also significant is while I was considered middle class, you know, and I mentioned this in my story, he financially abused me as well. And so when I left him 3 days later, my car was repossessed. A month later, my house went into foreclosure proceedings. And so I was jobless, carless, and potentially homeless within a month. I really had to reach out to friends and family who actually sort of stepped back in and helped me in that capacity, but it was because I didn't know about the other services. Between then and now, what has happened is because I started blogging using my pseudonym, some of the people that reached out to me actually told me that there were services available, which is how I found out about any sort of domestic violence advocacy or nonprofit in the area. And so this man who had been reading, his mom was a survivor, emailed me and said, you know, I don't know if you know about services, but if you, you know, Google domestic violence nonprofit, you will probably find some in your area. And so as soon as he said that, it was a year after I had left, I had already gone back into teaching, but I was seeing a lot of PTSD symptoms coming up in the classroom because I was teaching 17-year-old boys. And so, you know, I'm 5'2", and when these massive football players come up and ask for help, you know, it's not normal for a teacher to be pushing themselves up against a wall to make sure that they can't come at you from behind. And so I started to notice the differences in my teaching techniques. So when he said that, I said, okay, I do need help. Like, I didn't realize this was a thing. So I did a Google search, and I found Safe Connections and one other nonprofit in St. Louis called Alive. And I reached out to both, and Safe Connections was the first to get back to me. So I went in for an intake, an assessment, and then they put me on a waiting list. And because, you know, services are needed by so many people, I was on that waiting list for 6 months before I was able to get in for individual therapy. And so, that's telling right there. So I knew there was a problem. It was 18 months out of the relationship before I actually was able to get in to get those services. And they did have groups that I could have gone to in the interim so that, you know, while I was waiting for this individual therapy, I could be in group therapy. But I just was terrified of the whole process. So I was too scared to go. So I didn't, and I waited. And then I spent 3 years in intensive trauma therapy at Safe Connections, trying to heal and sort of come to terms with what happened and understand the dynamic and understand, you know, and kind of come out of the brainwashing that we've talked about. You know, I didn't know who I was anymore. And one of the examples that I use all of the time is that I didn't know if I liked grape jelly or if I liked strawberry jelly or what kind of jelly I liked anymore, because I wasn't sure if it was what he told me I should like or if I genuinely liked something. And so for 3 years, I went through, you know, therapy with them and sort of found myself again. And in doing that, I learned so much about just the dynamics of abuse and how prevalent it is in society, but we're so scared to talk about it, because if we talk about it, then it becomes a problem that could affect you. And so that's one of the things that I like to talk about a lot, is that, you know, one of the reasons I think that I was so ignorant to it was unintentional, but it was my fear of saying, hey, this could really happen to me, until it did happen. And then, you know, confronting people with that and saying, you know what, it happened to me, it can happen to anybody, is a terrifying prospect. And so when I started to see people respond to me in that way, I started to be pulled more to sharing my story so that I could, you know, better educate society and sort of empower these other women who have a story that want to share it, you know, because some people aren't ready and that's okay. But anybody that wants to share their story and, you know, is ready to help someone else and give them that strength. And so that's really after I graduated, I just graduated from Faith Connections Therapy in July of 2014. So it has not been that long, but ever since then it's been go, go, go for me on trying to get out there and raise awareness.
Well, and this is the connection between you and Ellen, is that you and Ellen have met recently, and you will be speaking at an event they have coming up at the end of April. Ellen, what attracted you to having Lindsay tell her story to your audience at your event?
First of all, she's very articulate, and she's a survivor. You know, and as you said at the introduction of the show, she's moved. She's not just a survivor, she's thriving, you know, and that is what, more than anything, what I want people to understand, that you move on, and can regain and grow anything that may have been lost during that period of time. It's a struggle, but it's there. So I really, when I met Lindsay, I was like, oh yeah, this is great. She also has a really fascinating story to tell. The book is such a good read. Well, it's a good read. It's well written. It's a relatively quick read, so you don't get bogged down in all sorts of extraneous other things. It's really about what happened. And the other piece is, you know, she's local. She is a local in a broad regional sort of way. And has sort of, you know, this is something that is real. It happens, and it happens to anybody. It could be you. It could be me. It could be Lindsay. And, in fact, it was. So when I met her, and she gave us a copy of the book that we've been passing around on the staff, it was like a sort of a natural fit, that here's somebody who can really is together enough to really tell this story.
Well, I'm happy to have played a small part in the introduction, and I think it is important to put a face on the issue, and, you know, that's why I'm committed to whatever I can to help Lindsay get her message out, and we'll be carrying her new book, The House on Sunset, at our new gift shop, Butterfly and Moon, which opens in May, and we'll have that there in
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. First time I've announced that on the air, actually.
Awesome.
But I think it will certainly bring discussion, and, you know, we will recommend the book to those that we think can benefit from it, but it will definitely, the more we talk about an issue and about violence against women in any form, the more we break down the stigma, the more we break down the barriers to healing, because so many people, I'm just amazed, like probably 4 out of 5 of my friends, I mean, so many people I know have either experienced domestic violence as children, witnessed it as an adult, have a friend, I have several friends who are mothers with daughters living currently in the situation, and I want to ask you a little bit about that, Ellen, in a minute here. But, Lindsay, what other groups have you spoken to? I know you spoke to my sorority, Alpha Chi Omega,
yes.
And that's a sorority that's dedicated to working on creating awareness around domestic violence. But how did that presentation come about, and are you planning to do more speaking at college campuses?
Yeah, I'm hoping to. So Alpha Chi Omega was an amazing experience because one of my cousins is actually very active still in the alumni activities and recruiting in her chapter specifically, which is at William Woods University. And so she knew that I was blogging. It was before the book was a thing. And asked me to come out and kind of share my story with the Greek students at William Woods. And so we did that. and it was a great experience. The funny part of that, though, Brenda, is that on the way home, I had just gotten back on Highway 70, so I had not been gone from them for very long. And she immediately called me and said, they want to alum initiate you. And so I went back to William Woods the next spring, and they alum initiated me. So I'm actually a member of Alpha Chi Omega as well.
But we'll have to get a story in the national magazine.
I know.
So
all
the chapters.
Yeah, I did. When the book came out, one of the things that I really wanted to do is because, you know, these nonprofits that offer these services typically are doing this to where, you know, I didn't pay a dime for my therapy. And at that point in my life, I couldn't have afforded it, which is why I didn't go in earlier. And so I have been, when it was self-published, now that it has a publisher, I can't do this anymore. And I'm kind of bummed about that. But I think I'm working out the details with them. But when I self-published, I actually hooked back up with Alpha Chi Omega and their foundation and did a 50-50 profit split with them for the first month that the book was out. So 50% of my sales went directly to their foundation, which then benefits not only the girls that are in the sorority and their education, but also all of the organizations that they work with independently. And so Alpha Chi Omega has been an amazing, I've actually spoken to an alumni chapter. I just did that last week. And I'm looking at speaking at Mizzou and then Missouri State and maybe, I think, KU. I'm not entirely sure. But now that I've sort of become known in the Alpha Chi Omega community, people keep reaching out, which is amazing because I am able to speak at, college campuses. And one of the other really cool things that I have recently done is because of my experience with the police department in St. Peter's, Missouri, asked me to come in and do some training. So I've already spoken to their new recruits about, you know, going into houses and what would be effective to ask somebody that's in that state of trauma. And just sharing my experience because, again, it is important to humanize it. And so many times these police officers go into these houses 6 or 7 times a day. They're getting these calls. And so, you know, you can really start to be jaded by it. And so when you can put a face to it and a face that's not in a traumatic state that can explain what's happening inside of that place, you know, it gives them a different outlook. And so after I spoke with their new recruits, their executive director emailed me and said, can you please come back and speak to St. Charles County active police officers? And so we're working out the details, but I do plan on going back and speaking to the officers that are actually out on the streets right now. So that's very exciting.
Excellent. And so with your book being picked up by, so you self-published it initially, and then you got picked up by a major publisher? Can you say which one?
It's Book Trope Publishing, which is actually in conjunction with Amazon. So it's fairly new, probably 2 years old, but they are growing at a rapid rate because Amazon is backing them. So I'm sure more and more books will be coming out under Book Trope. But, yeah, so I'm with them, and it's very exciting.
That is. And so will you be doing a book tour nationally or regionally beyond the speaking at these various nonprofit groups and with law enforcement groups?
I'm hoping. We are probably a week away from talking about, you know, the marketing side of it. It was a matter of I needed to do some revisions on the actual content, nothing huge, but I did add some details in places where I felt like they may be missing. And so I changed the book just a tiny bit, but so we had to go through the editing process and then the proofreading process, and now we're working on a different cover. And so once the cover is done and we have that scheduled, then we'll start talking about marketing. So I'm definitely hoping to do more, especially since the book will be coming out under my name now. So it will no longer be Serafina Bianco. It will be under Lindsay Fisher, and my picture will be on it. So anybody that has been following my blog will be able to see me for the first time in a way that, you know, they haven't yet. Which is going to be huge in and of itself. So the marketing stuff is sort of icing on the cake for me at this point, but I'm not sure where I'm headed yet, but I'm going wherever this will take me.
Well, I think it's going to take you to a lot of different places. And Ellen, I wanted to ask you, with the women you work with, do you encourage journaling and writing as a way, as a path to healing?
Absolutely. It can be so interesting to go back later and read what you have written and be surprised, actually, by what has come out on paper, you know, the emotions or the signals, the signs, the symptoms, and you can actually see how far you've come when
mm-hmm.
you go back and journal. Yeah, I think it's a great process.
And it's a place to put it instead of it being in your head, rumbling around,
yes.
Getting it out on paper. And
yes.
And whether it's blogging or journaling, you know, it's telling your truth. And I think as we tell our truth and share our secrets on paper, it breaks the power they have over us and over our lives. Lindsay, have you thought of doing any writing workshops for other women to encourage memoir writing?
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that I've thought about quite a bit because, you know, I call it, and this is not my phrase, but I found it online, and I call it narrative healing. And, you know, again, for me, it was really my only outlet or the only outlet that I was made aware of at that point. And so blogging really was a place for me to, you know, silence or quiet the anxiety and the panic and all of that good stuff. So I would love to be able to do that for other people. And I do, you know, some women will reach out to me after reading my blog or my book and ask me, you know, for help or to read their stuff. And so I have done a little bit. But the nice thing about that is since I have a degree in, you know, secondary education English, writing is kind of my thing. So I'm hoping to put something, some sort of program together and maybe either work in some of the nonprofits and see if I can get in, you know, and maybe do a group sort of setting, or through my website do something one-on-one. So I haven't fleshed it out yet, but it is in the works.
So speaking of website, it's sarafinabianco.com, sarafinabianco.com, and then I know you have a YouTube channel, House on Sunset, so people can find you on YouTube and they can go to your website. Will you be changing your website name from Sarafina Bianco to...
I will,
okay.
Yes. And Monday is the official. I have 2 hours with my designer that we are finalizing. You can actually see the website right now. It's SurvivorsWillBeHeard.com.
Survivors
with an S, yes. Survivors
will be heard.
Will be, yes.
Willbeheard.com. And we'll have to make sure to connect you to Zonta International, an international organization that works to end violence against women, of which I'm a member. And they have, I know in Missouri there's 3 chapters, but nationally there's hundreds of chapters all around the country, and they're often looking for speakers who can share about their personal stories. And I want to get back to Ellen that... they have a website. It's turningpointdvs.com, and
yes.
You can read about Turning Point's emergency shelter and supportive services, and also contact them. And so regardless of where you live, since our radio program can be heard anywhere, not only in the U.S. and the country, but around the world, but no matter where you live, you can actually call and get a resource for your area. Turning Point's a member of the United Way and can connect you to... Are you part of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Ellen?
We're listed through the National Domestic Violence Hotline, which is... And we are also on the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence online resource, and we are also listed through... what you just said, the United Way's 211 service, which is nationwide. So the wonderful thing is that the National Domestic Violence Hotline will help you connect to the resource in the area you need to be, even if that is not your home resource, if you're fleeing the area. So if you can just get to where you can look up the National Domestic Violence Hotline.
Yeah, I got that number right here. I want to give that out. It's 1-800-799- SAFE, S-A-F-E, which is also 7233. So 800-799-7233. And actually, any woman or man should put that phone number in their phone, so you can give it out to other people or tell your hairdresser or tell your doctor or your medical professional that number so that they have that number to share with people. To call that number, it's 24/7. You know, one phone call can not only help you but could save someone else's life. And they have trained advocates. They don't judge. There's no fees. They're just there to listen. And I think it first starts with calling and talking, because it might take several phone calls to develop a plan to leave if you're in an abusive situation. We did not get to cover what to do if you know someone, but in the last remaining minutes, Ellen, is there some tips that you can share that if you have a family member or a neighbor or someone you know who's living in an abusive situation, what you can do as a friend or a supportive person?
Sure. Very quickly, make sure they have the resources, the phone numbers. Let them decide whether or not they can keep those numbers on them. Keep the door open, but don't turn them in to the police unless there is an urgent right now event happening where you're afraid somebody's getting hurt. Because if other resources intervene too fast and she does not have her everything together, it can be more dangerous. So make sure she's got the resources. She has the phone numbers. It's written down safely. Encourage her to call us, and then you may have to let go and let it happen.
And that,
it can
that
be
is
very difficult.
That is a hard part to detach. And I notice on the websites, like on your websites and other domestic violence websites, it says, you know, if someone walks into the room, you need to escape this website immediately.
Exactly.
Does that not show up in the search listings, or does it show up?
You need to make sure you're clearing your cache regularly, but it does immediately take you off to another website. So if somebody else comes up behind you, at least they're not seeing that, and
yep.
you've got
okay.
that escape. So it's not as easy as us saying, now is the time for you to leave. I know you're a victim of domestic violence, so you should leave. It doesn't work that way. You need to give her the information, have her making the connection she needs to get the information she needs for safety planning to make sure she can do it safely. And it's incredibly important to understand that.
Well, that's
yeah.
great advice. And just in closing, that every shelter in your community needs support, needs products, whether it's toilet paper, dish detergent, paper towels, facial tissues. I mean, the next
yes.
time you go to Walmart, pick up an extra gift card, gas
yes.
cards of any amount. You can mail those to your local domestic violence provider. They need those gift cards more than they need toys at Christmas. I know, having worked
yes.
at a shelter,
yes.
getting piles and piles of toys does not help the women throughout the rest of the year with very real issues that
yes.
are in short supply, gas cards to get to job interviews and things like that. So think about a Christmas in July program for your nearest program. Get in touch with Turning Point if you're in this region, and continue to talk about these issues so that we can break the stigma and end violence against women, if that is possible. But we can hope that it is possible, at
yes.
least on an individual basis. So thank you, everyone. Lindsay, have a great weekend. Good luck with the book. Keep us posted as things will look at your new site, SurvivorsWillBeHeard.com. We'll make sure everyone knows about that. And, Ellen, good luck at your event next month.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone. We're going to end with the song Eye of the Tiger.